Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Welcome to another episode of my last interview series here at peterbcollins.com. Today, British journalist Andy Worthington returns.
Mi casa es su casa. The grass is greener on my side. And I got all my motos. Just me and my family. Mi casa es su casa. The grass is greener on my side. And I got all my motos. Just me and my family.
Hey, Chico. Idle the car while I went into the supermercado. Cop the Cuban hat, bootleg, come by segundo. I'm barbecue, you know, El Cubano on it. It's time, no blues, bro. The vibe is Cuba. Give 20s and a couple of wise words to the kids.
The song is called Guantanamo. It's a bouncy Cubano thing, a little bit inappropriate for the subject matter. But I found it on Spotify, and it's by a band called Outlandish. Andy Worthington, it's been too long. Great to have you back on the Peter B. Collins podcast.
Thank you for inviting me on, Peter. And thanks for that tune as well. I've never heard that one before.
No, me either. So, Andy, I wanted to include you in my last interview series because you and I have been talking for more than 15 years, first on my syndicated radio show. And I remember you came to the secret studio at least once, maybe twice, and hung out with us here in California. And your dedication and persistence to exposing the evils of America's gulag in the Caribbean really stand out in a signal way. And I wanted to reflect that in this conversation because most Americans have moved on. And Guantanamo is clearly in the rearview mirror. They don't have a clue that about 40 men remain there, some who face indefinite detention without charge or trial. And the gross injustice of it all is not lost on many Americans, but our political leaders and the corporate media think that we don't care, and they've given up on covering it. Carol Rosenberg, who has now moved to the New York Times, is perhaps as stalwart as you in her dedication to covering Guantanamo, but they don't give her that much space in the paper and not very often.
Yeah. Are you there, Peter?
Yes, yes. I was leaving an opening for you to comment.
Sorry, yes. Well, yes, it's I was on a journey there of amnesia about Guantanamo. Because it has been such a shockingly long amount of time. And as you say, you know, it's largely been forgotten. And partly, of course, that's the last 4 years. So, you know, we had a president, Donald Trump, who tweeted even before he was inaugurated, there must be no more releases from Gitmo. These are all dangerous people. And, you know, and was pretty much true to his word. So he was obliged to release one of the 41 men he inherited from Barack Obama, a man who had agreed to a plea deal in his military commission trial, in which, in exchange for providing evidence in the 9/11 trial, he was sent back for continued imprisonment in Saudi Arabia. And I did wonder how that one would have played out if Trump had been told that he was being sent back to be freed in Saudi Arabia. The fact that he was being sent to continued imprisonment, I'm sure, pleased him. Mm-hmm. But as far as, you know, as everything else went with Guantanamo, he had no interest in releasing anybody. And that showed up, I think, the continuing monstrous injustice of Guantanamo, which is that if the president of the United States, whoever he is, and if the Congress don't want a prisoner released from Guantanamo, they're not going to be released. It's as simple as that. So they effectively, the men still held at Guantanamo are to some extent, viewable as political prisoners, prisoners held at the whim of the president and of the United States Congress, rather than anything to do with the law, which, you know, decent Americans believe their country was founded with respect for the rule of law and that the rule of law continues to mean something. And at Guantanamo, it really clearly doesn't. So, you know, that's been the situation. And now we're back to, you know, what is it now? Is this Obama 2, the return? You know, Joe Biden, Barack Obama's former vice president, he becomes the president. And, you know, immediately we know, honestly, we know that there will be people within his administration, perhaps even some of the same people who served under Obama, who will know and maybe even will acknowledge on occasion that there is something fundamentally grossly wrong about Guantanamo. But whether it will be closed is a matter of political calculation, shall we say, and of, you know, and possibly of power struggles within Congress, depending on who ends up in control of the Senate, which I think still hasn't been decided.
You're correct. Yes. And Andy, the one barometer you alluded to this a moment ago is we can't expect Republicans to lift a finger to address the kangaroo courts, these military commissions that have a different presiding officer every year. I think we're number six now or something like that in recent years. But we had to get a stretch clown car to fit in all of the Democrats who ran in the presidential primaries. But I don't recall anybody, maybe Tulsi Gabbard raised it once, but nobody talked about Guantanamo. The media didn't bring it up in, these protracted debates. What do we have, 20 plus debates over the course of a year and a half? And, foreign policy itself was rarely discussed. But the issues of Guantanamo were just completely, sketched out of the whole process. And at this point, I think I know Joe Biden and his record pretty well. I don't have a clue about where he stands on closing Guantanamo. Would he, stand up to Chuck Schumer to bring trials into the U.S. court system? These are questions really that nobody asked and we don't have answers to.
Yeah, it's true, Peter. I mean, there has been a certain amount of people behind the scenes, NGOs, lawyers, talking to people that are part of the Biden team. So there are people, now trying to talk about these issues as we approach the inauguration. And, it's pretty clear that on let's take a few issues, for example. One is that five of the 40 men still held were unanimously approved for release by high-level government review processes established by Barack Obama, but didn't, for one reason or another, get released before Donald Trump took over. So that's a really difficult one for Biden's team to ignore, because they will have pressure put on them, by fellow Democrats who happen to be in the business of wanting to get Guantanamo closed. And I think also the issue that Congress has kicked back every year in the National Defense Authorization Act for many years now. And that's, as I say, that's why it's going to be interesting to see what the political power balance is in Congress. If Biden can, have the whole of Congress, it would make things a bit easier. But
let me jump in there, Andy, because we have to look at the composition of the Democratic members of the Senate. and they have become more conservative. And it's not just Chuck Schumer who would object to amending the laws that now prevent allowing a Guantanamo detainee to even step foot in the United States for medical care, for a trial, for imprisonment, nothing. And so that is a heavy lift, even if the Georgia Senate races miraculously produced two Democrats. We don't know anything about Raphael Warnock, and John Ossoff is a pretty conservative Democrat. The newest other member is Mark Kelly, the former astronaut, who was just sworn in to complete John McCain's term. And he's very clear that he is a centrist, a moderate, who is not going to rock the boat. And so we have very little leadership of people who would advocate for what you and I view as the right things related to Guantanamo.
Yeah, I mean, I think the particular issue at the moment is the medical issue. So, you know, we have these aging prisoners at Guantanamo, many of them getting more and more ill as time goes on. And, the facility at Guantanamo Bay is not set up for dealing with that. But persistently, efforts to incorporate changes into the National Defense Authorization Act that prevent any prisoner being brought to the U.S. mainland for any reason have always been turned down. And yet this year, that process was almost slightly mysterious in a way, because it had Republican backing at one point for the medical side of things. Mm-hmm. So I actually realistically could see that one happening, because if you're going to chip away at Guantanamo in any way, then one way of dealing with it is, okay, we'll do medical emergencies. We're also going to sort out releasing a few more people. So we'll set up, you know, we'll make sure that the review process for the forever prisoners who make up most of the men still held, that also starts moving again. And we'll make arrangements for releasing some of these five guys long cleared for releasing. We can do that as well. Whether it goes any further is the bigger question, I think, Peter, as to whether the facility actually gets closed. And that's where I think it gets a bit stickier. Mm-hmm. Because apart from anything else, I mean, I'm made hopeful by this, because I can now finally start to advocate again for the fact that genuinely insignificant people are still held at Guantanamo, and they're only held there because they've had a bad attitude since they've been held. In other words, they have reacted badly to the horrendous ways that they have been imprisoned without due process for 19 years nearly. And have, gone on hunger strikes, or they've been people who've shown leadership potential. So they've been cell block leaders who've agitated for the rights of their fellow prisoners, which always makes you be regarded as a threat. Cases of potential mistaken identity, I think, are still at Guantanamo, and other people whose significance has been inflated over the years. I would say that when we look at the alleged intelligence about the men held at Guantanamo, for the most part, it has involved over-cautious appraisal of the threat posed by the men who have been held there. And each time that there's an attempt to review it, it chips away at it slightly. But the default position is always to be worried about, as it has been from the beginning, to be worried about releasing the wrong person. You know, during Bush's time, there were people who were quite obsessed about that, but politically, it became unpopular for a while under Bush, so he released a whole load of prisoners in a way that by the time Obama got in, there was a huge backlash about that. And all these unsubstantiated claims of recidivism that actually emanated from a department within the government that were constantly saying, you know, how many people have returned to the battlefield. Mm-hmm. So I would hope that we'll have progress on some of the easier things. The more difficult things, like, you know, the men that are still held that are allegedly responsible for, major crimes like the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, cannot receive a fair trial in the military commission system because it simply doesn't work. the basis for it is that the government is obsessed with hiding the information about the torture of these men. Right. And the defense team, of course, is equally obsessed with exposing the torture of the men, without which there can't be a fair trial. What worries me, and I think it should worry Americans who care about these issues and want to think about it, is suggestions that I've heard that the CIA is really quite happy for them to stay forever in a stalled, looping Groundhog Day process of pretrial hearings that never reaches a trial, especially with judges who are changing place all the time, because they don't want any of this aired. And they're happy for these men to be held literally for the rest of their lives without there ever being a trial. And that, I think, is something that, you know, will be talked about in certain places in the corridors of power, which, you know, could mean that we never do see the end of Guantanamo. But what I would settle for is, you know, let's at least get half of these men out of there, because they don't need to be there. There is no case against them that could justify them being held for nearly 20 years.
And Andy, I want to put a marker down here, because Barack Obama is out on a book tour promoting a memoir that he and his wife got a total of $64 million in advance money from publishers for.
For a book?
Yes, yes. I mean, it's just stunning. And he was on a late night comedy show, Stephen Colbert, the other night. And it's interesting because Colbert is mostly a comic, but he did ask some serious questions of Obama. And at one point, Obama volunteered his own disappointment that he hadn't closed Guantanamo. But there was no follow-up to say, well, you know, what about the interoperability, the impossible structure of these military commissions? What about the fact that you failed to hold anyone accountable for torture? And we have Gina Bloody Haspel running the CIA. And Obama is appointing Avril Haines, who was at the CIA and is tainted by the torture program, to be the director of national intelligence. And so as long as people who had some role or responsibility in the torture rendition and detention processes are still active in government, they're going to be doing their best to keep the lid on. And we saw when Dianne Feinstein, who, you know, I've been a critic of her as my California senator almost from the day she took office, but her shining moment was forcing the Intelligence Committee to produce the torture report, which was then just completely buried with the help of the Obama White House and the CIA. And so the failure to expose the crimes, to hold a single person accountable, leaves us in this zone. And, you know, Obama made this big blunder of making it his day one move. And you know, we've seen presidents do this. Bill Clinton, his day one was allowing gays to serve openly in the military. And it was right-wing Democrats who sat on him and made him adopt the obnoxious don't ask, don't tell policy. And Obama didn't consult with his own party members when he made his grand pronouncement about closing Guantanamo on day one. So to some extent, it's a relief that it's not on Biden's day one agenda, because maybe with less attention on it, he might actually be able to provide the relief that you suggest to the five who are cleared. But nobody appears has any stomach to deal with the issues of the forever prisoners. And when Obama went and gave that speech in front of at the National Archives, in front of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, it was a real low point in his administration. And he rationalized this Solomonic split the baby bullshit that we can have a constitution and deny these prisoners fundamental human and judicial rights.
Yeah. Well, no, absolutely. And I do think the problem that you highlighted there, Peter, is that he gets away without being challenged about it, to the extent that he is now back in the public eye. And that, as you say, there he is on a TV show that a lot of people are watching. He mentions Guantanamo, but there's no follow-up. Presumably, his interview with Colbert was probably told, don't follow up. He's going to say this, but we're not going into that one. Because, you know, what he should be asked is, why did you fail to close it? And it's really not as simple as saying, you know, I had this opposition from the Republicans. It's like, no, you didn't want to spend the political capital actually making sure that the job was finished. You know, and for whatever reasons those are, you know, Rahm Emanuel is one particularly unfortunate reason. Mm-hmm. But, you know, but so is how much do you go up against the military, the CIA, the whole of this, you know, the whole of this story, which is actually quite an interesting one, because, you know, you will remember, Peter, when Obama, during his first few months, he actually unclassified some of the torture memos that we hadn't seen. These mm-hmm. were like reiterations of the John Yoo and Jay Bybee torture memos from 2002, which were reissued by a man called Stephen Bradbury, who was a kind of replacement for these guys. And, you know, the CIA were clearly appalled that Obama had started, you know, releasing things that they wanted hidden. And the next time that this was as in relation to a court case, the next time a court case turned up, it was about photos of torture and abuse and other, as I understand it, heinous crimes committed by the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, that one never went any further. Those documents, those photos were not released. And that was May 2009. That was the point at which any notion that we had that Barack Obama was going to go up against the military-industrial spy complex were dashed, I think, really. And, you know, and I do still think there's an element of that, that you go up against a body that, you know, has a history, shall we say, perhaps of getting rid of people who intrude too far into their business. Because, you know, when it comes down to it, who is running what within America?
Yeah. Yeah. So let's just let me ask you to just briefly recap the change of the guard recently. Because they've been having a really hard time maintaining stable staffing at Guantanamo at the very top. And the judges presiding over the tribunal have come and gone. And we've had a scandal related to the untimely death of a soldier whose wife was having an affair with a top commander. And so it becomes even more sordid as we look at the failure to even run a clean operation, to even, you know, maintain any forward momentum on these long-delayed trials of the suspects of 9/11.
Yeah. And I think if you look at the, you know, if you look at some of the really hardworking defense lawyers who are on these cases and trying to stick with them, as long as possible in the hope of, if not securing justice, preventing injustice from prevailing. Can the whole thing go on forever? Can it go on for another 10 years without the trials really materializing? Or, you know, it's another one of the things that Barack Obama should have been asked, you know?
Yeah.
He let Eric Holder announce to the world that the 9/11 trial would be held in New York. He made that announcement almost exactly 11 years ago. And yet, you know, when there was pushback against Obama, then he dropped the plan. He shouldn't have dropped the plan. And where we're at now, Peter, is, you know, does the broken system end up just grinding to a halt? You know, who knows, 5 years from now when the people involved just have to retire. They can't do it anymore. You know, no one has the will anymore to keep the whole thing going, which I could see happening. Or is there going to be an effort to say this needs to finish? And, you know, and I've always, you know, suspected, and there's something slightly unfortunate about it, but It applies to so many terrorism cases, and this, you know, this would be the biggest terrorism case of all, is that all you need to do when you put on a trial is just suggest something plausible to the jury and, you know, try not to maybe, you know, maybe say, sorry, all this torture stuff happened. What was it Obama said? We tortured some folks.
Yeah, right.
I think that was his, you know, that's it. We apologized for it. You know, it wouldn't take much for people to be convicted. And maybe that's what should happen. But, you know, I just don't know. I mean, I think there's a disintegration. I used to think of the military commissions as just being kind of like Groundhog Day. And in a way, I think they are. But I think it's like the entire Groundhog Day process is also disintegrating. So each time it goes through this futile cycle of getting nowhere, the very components of the reality of it are disappearing. I don't know how it can end. And it's an indictment of everything about Guantanamo now is still an indictment of the horrendous arrogance and hubris of the Bush administration and the officials who set up a prison in the first place by breaking all the rules governing the imprisonment of people in countries that claim to respect the law.
Yeah.
All of them. And, you know, and that once you've done that, you can't, once you've instituted a broken process, you can't put the pieces back together again. And we're stuck with it nearly 20 years later.
Well, Andy, the other thing that compounds this is that public opinion in the United States has shifted further against any reasonable course of action related to Guantanamo. And the people who opposed Bush's wars, tolerated Obama's conversion to drones and covert action as preferable to boots on the ground. But since 2016, the whole Russiagate scam has led a lot of people to follow these, what I consider to be grossly false claims. And I, you know, it's always awkward because I'm not a Trump defender in any way. But, you know, the whole Mueller investigation is what I call a limited hangout operation. They intentionally didn't go deep. And when they came up with virtually nothing, you know, a lot of people still took it as some confirmation of significant interference by Russia. And this has led to a much more bellicose Democratic Party. And they've also recruited to run for Congress veterans of the intelligence and military communities. And so we now have a generation of people who have grown up believing that Guantanamo is the receptacle for the worst of the worst, and they really don't have any curiosity to look further, to understand what you just described, that its very foundation is law-breaking, and yeah. It's supposed to be this, you know, beacon of justice that shines across these United States and amber waves of grain and all that stuff. And,
yeah.
And so it has become a caricature. And I know way too many people who I'll mention Guantanamo, and they just shut down immediately.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not about shutting down Guantanamo. It's they think it's justified and that these people threatened us and that, you know, the myths of 9/11 have been promoted to the point where it's just, you know, it's not something that can be easily reopened.
No. And, you know, and that's a very sad thing. And it's, you know, it's always been the case. I mean, you know, when we had British prisoners in Guantanamo, the level of engagement in general amongst the British public and the level of opposition towards Guantanamo was, you know, was enormous compared to the, you know, to the interest in the United States, you know, which has always been tiny of anyone prepared to engage in the issue and really, really to think about it, you know, and that's even amongst, you know, intellectual liberals who are supposed to care about it, but actually they can't even bear to look in the mirror and have Guantanamo reflected back at them for more than a second because it freaks them out. So they can't deal with it either. I mean, it's, you know, it is terrible. The thing that gives me this notion that there will be progress on it is that it's a kind of policy geek lawyer issue that's going on. And the same way that the apology that Obama made on TV the other night, you know, which is one that we actually heard from people that were close to Obama when he was in office, who, you know, would hand ring at parties when they met people advocating for the closure of Guantanamo and say, you know, there isn't a day that goes by that we aren't, you know, that we aren't really upset that we haven't managed to do this, as though, you know, as though they really didn't have the power, as though the president really isn't the commander in chief. For all of that, when it comes down to issues of the policy of keeping Guantanamo open and the justification for that, that is when, you know, policy wonks and lawyers and people who are about, you know, both inside the administration and outside it trying to put pressure on it. This is what they do. And, you know, I am just so relieved after Trump. I mean, Trump effectively put up a wall around himself where no one could get in and communicate with him on any level unless it was of interest to him. And he put a wall up around Guantanamo. He sealed the prison shut. He turned it into a tomb for nearly 4 years for the men held there. So, you know, this is progress. Notwithstanding all the other problems that we have, Peter, and, you know, the difficulties that we have when we look at a Democratic Party that hasn't been in office for 4 years, you know, where we had an aberration from the military-industrial complex for 4 years in the White House in some ways. But now we've got this, you know, this warmongering Democratic machine back again. And as a Brit, I mean, it's not as though we're really much better. I mean, I don't know whether you saw recently, but the Boris Johnson government has just pledged to spend tens of billions of pounds of new money on Britain's war machinery, on our defense budget. Mm-hmm. You know, with COVID, with everything that's going on, they're suddenly deciding that's a priority. But it always amazes me that in the United States, there is so little concerted opposition to the absolutely mind-bending amounts of money that are spent in your so-called defense budget.
Andy, right now, the budget for the Pentagon, the NDDAA, is in the queue to be voted on in the lame duck session. And Trump is trying to attach an unrelated issue to it, which relates to the rules whether Facebook and Twitter are publishers or not. And the chair of that committee has rejected Trump's call, but Trump is threatening to veto the NDAA. And this creates howls of disapproval. And the discussion that this is a bipartisan bill to support our military. And nobody says, do we really need to spend $700 billion plus? What are we funding? Where does this money go? And, you know, what values does it undermine or destroy? None of that. Okay. It's just a given that the Pentagon is off limits for debate. And, you know, they even shoveled an extra $70 billion into the Pentagon, unbudgeted, in the last NDAA. And that has true bipartisan support. Almost every Democrat will vote for that.
Exactly. And, you know, but that last bill was before COVID. So, you know, after 8 months of COVID, we still have elected officials who behave as though nothing has happened to the economy. Nothing has happened to our economic landscape over the last 8 months.
Well, I'm not dismissing your observation here, but I will say that you know, for those of us who live in this maw every day, it's just mind-boggling, because, you know, the rationalization, okay, right now they're trying to come up with a limited bill to extend unemployment benefits and provide a little relief to small businesses that have been hammered because we're going into a second wave and, you know, they're not calling them lockdowns, but that's what they are. And so suddenly the Republicans are concerned about the deficit after they gave away $2 trillion in tax cuts to corporations and the wealthy and passed out $3 trillion in April, a full third of which went to Wall Street and corporate interests. And two-thirds, I'm sorry, only one-third actually went to the average citizen. So we are so out of any sense of reality when it comes to balancing these issues and recognizing that smart cuts to the Pentagon would be a great way to fund the languishing domestic needs. That doesn't fly because it's all about, you know, staking out extreme philosophical positions. And that's, you know, that's what has been holding sway here for far too long.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, you know, it's I wouldn't say it's much better here either, Peter, but that's, you know, that's perhaps beyond the remit of our conversation in general, is that, you know, we have been presented with challenges and opportunities to change how our countries operate, partly to deal with the horrendous human cost of the pandemic, and partly because, you know, we so desperately need to change direction on certain issues, environmental issues, for example.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, we're not given that much opportunity to have somebody who's outside of all of this suggesting radical alternatives. I mean, you know, and unfortunately, that's the situation you have with, you know, with the Biden administration, is that, you know, there's nothing genuinely radical and progressive and necessary, it seems to me, about this incoming administration, sadly.
Well, and they're going to use the excuse, we need to rebuild and restore all the stuff that Trump destroyed. So, you know, don't ask us for anything big. No heavy lifting, nothing controversial. Andy, I want to move on to another issue, but before we leave Guantanamo, I just wanted to note for your interest that Morris Davis, who was a prosecutor who resigned in protest, he ran for Congress in North Carolina in November, and he lost. He lost to a 20-something kid who is a complete idiot. It's breathtaking how bad his opponent was.
His opponent is a Republican, Peter, or what?
His opponent was a Republican who is a deep Trumper. He took a little trip to Berchtesgaden because of his interest in Hitler.
Oh my God! Oh, that's really sad because I knew that Mo was standing and had followed some of the progress of that this year, but I hadn't kept up with where it had ended up. That's very sad.
It is, yeah. And I did an interview with Mo back in August or September, once I discovered that he was running. And he was pretty optimistic at that point, but the red wave, particularly in a state like North Carolina, is very hard to counter.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah, I'm sorry, I'm just laughing again because I'm looking at the situation we're in the UK. You know, and, you know, I have my interest in American politics, obviously, and, you know, but this is where I live every day, and, you know, the nonsense we have to put up with.
Indeed, yeah. The other thing is, I just wanted to ask you to share with our listeners, how is Shaker Amer? He's been out five and a half years now, and you spearheaded that effort. And let me just remark that you are an interesting combination because you're a hard-nosed journalist who digs up the facts. You're very realistic in that respect. And you led a successful campaign to shame the British government into pressuring the U.S. government to release Shaker. And that requires a great deal of hope beyond reality. And so that's what makes Andy Worthington a really remarkable individual to me.
Well, you know, thank you, Peter. And, you know, it's funny when you mention those, the hope, because my hope now with Biden, and I'll just mention a couple of names briefly, but, you know, and people can hopefully go and look up more and find stuff that I've written and that other people have written. Saifullah Paraka, model prisoner at Guantanamo, Guantanamo's oldest prisoner, universally respected and admired by fellow prisoners and by the U.S. military personnel, is still held, one of the forever prisoners. His son was actually accused of terrorism and convicted on the U.S. mainland, had his conviction overturned and thrown out of court, and is now back home in Pakistan while his father still languishes in Guantanamo. And Khalid Qasim is another forever prisoner who's an incredibly talented artist, appears to be a natural leader of men, and so has this role within Guantanamo of having represented his fellow prisoners. But that has led him into conflict with the authorities. You know, these are, my hope is that I will somehow, with other people, be able to get these stories out about these men as we approach the 20th anniversary of the opening of Guantanamo, which is in January 2022, which, you know, no decent American wants to be waving a flag on that particular day and saying, isn't it great? Guantanamo's been open for 20 years. Mm-hmm. No charge, no trial, the pure dictatorship prison. But, you know, I digress, Peter. It was the notion of hope, that hope that I have that drives me.
Understood.
That led me to want to, you know, bring these contemporary stories in. With Shakar Amer, yeah, I had that hope. And I must say I was one of many, many people who worked to get Shakar Amer out of Guantanamo. And, you know, three very significant people were, well, actually there were more than three. There were a number of significant MPs in the UK who worked on Shakar Amer's case. So there was John McDonnell, who for a while here was the shadow chancellor of the Exchequer after Jeremy Corbyn, who was also part of the process, you know, unexpectedly became the Labour Party leader in 2015. And they played a huge role in it, as did a group of four MPs, including Jeremy Corbyn, who went to Washington in the spring of 2015, two conservatives, two Labour, to meet with senators to try and push for Shaka's release. But yeah, I was part of, you know, a couple of campaigns in the UK. We had the Daily Mail newspaper behind us, which is a right-wing newspaper, but on certain issues regarding the law tends to be more liberal, and for some reason, they rallied behind this the basic premise was, he may be a bad man, but this isn't the way that you should be treating anybody. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of pressure for securing Shakar Amer's release. And I'm glad to say that, you know, I've been I'm in communication with him every now and then. I, you know, send him an email and ask him if he'll take part in one of the poster campaigns for the Close Guantanamo campaign that I run, where basically every 100 days I have a poster telling the President of the United States how many days the prison has been open and why it needs to be shut.
Right.
And it was 6,900 days just a few days ago, Peter. But I saw Shakar most recently. I saw him about a year ago, and he was, you know, he was very well, actually. Which I was extremely pleased about. And I think he's, you know, he's taken the time to be with his family and to be with friends and to recover from his very long and difficult ordeal, actually, because the main thing really about Shakar is that it seems to me that every day that he was in Guantanamo and he was in U.S. custody for nearly 14 years, he fought them. You know, he fought them with the intention of breaking them rather than them breaking him.
Yeah.
You know, and he long periods in solitary, repeatedly brutalized by the guards because he wouldn't do what he was told. You know, and he deliberately took them on that basis his last year in Guantanamo, when he was allowed to go to the recreation yard for an hour a day. He would mm-hmm. go there, and he did this for months. He did this, that when they called him in at the end of his hour, he refused to come. So they had to go and beat him up to bring him in. And he did that every day until eventually they gave up. He broke them.
Mm-hmm. The thing that is indelible for me was when Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes was given a tour of the prison, and Shocker piped up from his cell. And this was captured on video, and a portion of it was played on the broadcast. And what was so stunning to me is that Leslie Stahl didn't know who the fuck he is.
Yes, I know.
And it's like, how, you know, I understand how these correspondents work, but to be handed scripts and questions and just go through the motions and not to have understood the whole campaign to free Shocker and the injustice that had been imposed on him, that was a shocker, and forgive the pun. But to see a major media outlet like that fumble it so badly was, you know, like I said, something I won't forget. So, Andy, I want to, before we wrap up, get your report on the extradition hearings for Julian Assange, which were held in September and October. And you were called as a witness by the defense. And if I have it correct, because of the COVID rules, at first they were going to have you deliver testimony by video. And then the judge in the case, Beretzer, just basically said, never mind, you know, submit his written statement. So take a couple of minutes here, if you would, to describe your observations about those proceedings. Vanessa Beretzer is supposed to issue her determination, which I believe will permit the extradition of Assange on very problematic legal terms, despite the overwhelming evidence that was presented in the extradition hearing process.
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, I was supposed to go and present my evidence in court. But I was prevented from doing so on a number of occasions because the prosecutors had raised issues about certain statements, certain things that I had said in my statements, which seemed particularly to deal with issues relating to the torture program, funnily enough. So I submitted a first statement in February, and then, you know, things didn't happen for months, and then I was supposed to read that out. And then when these problems happened, then I submitted a second statement clarifying certain issues. And in fact, partly explaining that to have U.S. prosecutors try to claim that the torture program didn't exist was rather ridiculous. And so I, you know, actually found sources, including the Senate Intelligence Committee report, to establish that, you know, that what reality actually was. But they wouldn't let me be interviewed. And in fact, I think they were rattling through things pretty quickly by the end. Judge Beretzer wanted to get things over and done with. Although there is another angle to it, Peter, which is that, you know, I was up for it, but I was also nervous about it because, you know, I don't have any professional history of dealing with cross-examinations. And I know that what was happening in that courtroom was that the prosecutor was appallingly aggressive to a number of the expert witnesses, you know, in a completely unacceptable manner,
mm-hmm.
In trying to destroy them in the courtroom. And that, you know, I know that the defense were rather worried about that.
Well, and Craig Murray, I think, gave us very detailed reports on the efforts to impeach witnesses, the scurrilous attempts to question their credentials.
Exactly.
And so, you know, your concern there was well warranted.
But in the end, you know, what was although I believe that my statements were submitted and the prosecutor still insisted on a couple of redactions in the final versions. From what I understand, what was actually read into the court record was a kind of, you know, breakneck speed summary of elements of it, which doesn't really particularly seem satisfactory. But, you know, my observation about the entire process, which I think is significant, Peter, is that it kind of looked like it was, you know, a fair process of debate within a courtroom. But it wasn't. This wasn't a trial. All this was negotiating over aspects of the extradition case as to whether Julian Assange should or shouldn't be extradited to the United States, all of which was kind of made up. I mean, what is there to stop the judge from having decided beforehand what she was going to do and just going through the motions? You know, which I don't think is generally what you could say is what you would expect from a well-argued court case with the prosecution and defense and with a judge and with a jury. My suspicion, as with yours, Peter, is that she will indeed approve Julian Assange's extradition because that's what she intended all along. It's great that all that evidence exists and, for people who want to take an interest in it. And more crucially, you know, elements of that will be used undoubtedly to challenge through the Court of Appeals any decision taken by Judge Barreto that Julian Assange must be extradited, because I don't think that that is by any means the end of the story. But that the whole thing felt a bit like a farce, I have to say.
Indeed. And Andy, from what I know, there is some tension between the U.S.-UK extradition treaty and a law passed by Parliament related to extradition. Do both of those they're not comparable. One is a law, one is a treaty. But in each case, is there not an exception for what is considered political offenses?
Yes, and, as far as I understand it, there is. But but that's one of the many issues that are problematic about this case. Obviously, you know, because the other very problematic side of it is that Julian Assange was functioning as a publisher in the same way that any publisher who is leaked information that is damaging to a government but that is important for it to be in the public domain is released. And the difference between liberal Western democracies and dictatorships is that liberal Western democracies, however much they fight against it, at some level have elements within their administrations that recognize that this is the price that you pay for not being a dictatorship. It's really that simple. And it's really funny how it's really not that dissimilar to the core Guantanamo issues, which is that when you imprison people indefinitely without charge or trial, that makes you a dictatorship. There's no way of dressing it up. That is what dictatorships do. And so the attempt to crucify Julian Assange for publishing information that was leaked by Chelsea Manning that has embarrassed the United States government and that in some ways has quite possibly exposed the commitment of war crimes by people working on or behalf of the United States government, this is not something that should lead to him being extradited to the United States. What I wonder at the moment is what the position of the Biden administration is, because there must be people within the Biden administration who, you know, were connected to the people within the Obama administration who concluded correctly that although they wanted to take down Julian Assange, the effect of prosecuting him would have such a chilling effect on the precious First Amendment rights in the United States that they couldn't do it. And I would love to see that be an issue within the Biden administration. But, you know, I'm not going to hold my breath for that one.
No, but I do think it's an unknown. And so there is, I think it's worthy to hope.
I mean, what I actually hope, Peter, is that, you know, is that people are finding people to talk to within the transition team to raise it as an issue, because there are clearly, you know, a lot of very talented people involved in the field of the law and human rights who, you know, who had the White House turn a deaf ear to them for 4 years. And opening up those channels of communication again has got to be a good thing. I mean, I really would not think that lawyers within the Biden administration would want to take on this case that I think they would ultimately lose. I don't think it's worth it. I mean, obviously, what I'd really like to happen, Peter, is that we could get rid of our disgraceful and useless government that we have here in the UK, so that we could drop the extradition process at this end. Mm-hmm. But it unfortunately doesn't seem likely that that's going to happen in the near future.
So, Andy, just briefly thumbnail the elements of your statement. I didn't get to read it, but my sense of it is that you established that the Guantanamo files that were released, and that's also the name of your book, by the way, but that the files that were released by Chelsea Manning offered evidence of torture and other criminal behavior by the U.S. government, which again goes to the argument that the effort to extradite and try and convict Assange in the United States is a political operation aimed at maintaining a cover-up of that criminal past.
Right. Well, I mean, my main thing was that, you know, I described the publication of those files as the anatomy of a colossal crime committed by the United States at Guantanamo and the men being held there, because those files, you know, it takes cross-referencing, Peter, but if you cross-reference the information in those files with other sources, in other words, with some journalistic research and some evidence that was established by lawyers working on behalf of prisoners that they represented, then you realize that what purports to be the evidence in those files actually names names for the first time to establish that it's not evidence at all. What it is a large number of people at Guantanamo who, for one reason or another, and I'm really not blaming them, made false statements about their fellow prisoners, which were then relied upon by the US authorities to justify the unjustifiable ongoing imprisonment of these people. And that is still the great truth about the Guantanamo files, which, you know, which A, no one was really that interested in, and B, just to make sure that no one was going to pay any attention to them, the United States decided 1 week after those files were released that they suddenly had to assassinate Osama bin Laden. And shift the narrative to one which established falsely that it was torture that led to finding Osama bin Laden. It wasn't. And that it was the existence of facilities, including Guantanamo, that was essential for establishing the context that led to the intelligence that led to finding Osama bin Laden in the first place, which was also untrue. But, you know, that's what they did. And I still find it hard to believe that it was coincidental that those files were only out in the public eye for a week before the entire thing was shut down. Because I believe that there are people within the United States establishment who want Guantanamo open because they like holding people forever without charge or trial, and who also are obsessed with hiding the evidence of the wrongdoing that was committed by U.S. officials, up to and including the President of the United States, all the way down through the lawyers and the advisors and the people who implemented various forms of torture and abuse.
Well, Andy, as we wrap up, I just want to tell you how grateful I am to your persistence, the hard work over so many years that you have put into our problem here in the United States.
Well, and there is a reason that it's called human rights, though, Peter, which is that, you know, it applies to all of us.
Well, you are really a bright light in raising that awareness, in trying to maintain fundamental standards of human rights. And you've done it all on a shoestring. I want to plug that you've got a fundraising drive underway right now. It's pretty modest. And if people can chip in to support your continued work, I would very much appreciate it. And I also want to mention that you're not an obsessive one-issue guy. You do a lot of work on issues in the United Kingdom. And as we wrap up the podcast here today, I want to play a little bit of one of your songs from your band, The Four Fathers. And this one is about the fire at the Grenfell Towers. I found it on YouTube.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah. Oh, well, thank you very much, Peter. That's great. Yeah.
And I believe Andy's...
Haven't been many opportunities to play lately for some reason.
Well, you and many other performers have been prevented from performing your art. But we'll play a little bit of the Grenfell song here with great gratitude and oodles of respect for what you have contributed to trying to right the wrongs of America over the course of a generation now.
Well, thank you, Peter. And, you know, and it's been a real pleasure talking to you again. I hope it won't quite be the last time that we talk about these issues. Maybe, you know, maybe as you recede into the broadcasting sunset, you may want to just pop back every now and then and keep an eye on what's happening with Guantanamo, if we ever resolve it.
All right. Well, when news breaks, I will keep that in mind and see if that's when I'll break my silence. All right. Andy Worthington joining us from London today here on one of my last interviews at the Peter B. Collins podcast. Thanks, Andy.
Thanks, Peter.
Chelsea, where the richest people live, ATO.